Hello and welcome to the October IASB Update podcast. My name is Claire Short and I am part of the communications team at the IFRS Foundation. Today I am joined by Andreas Barkov and Sue Lloyd, Chair and Vice Chair of the IASB respectively. In this episode, we'll look at some of the topics discussed at the board meeting held from the 25th through to the 28th of October 2021, before turning the discussion to some other highlights from the previous month or so. Andreas, we'll start with you. Some of the board's biggest projects were on this month's agenda, and I'd like you to take us through the developments across these. Could you start by telling us about goodwill and impairment? Last month, the board approved a project plan on development of disclosures on business combinations, and this month, you started tackling some of the specifics.
Yes, of course. Hi, everyone. This month, we looked at whether to develop proposals to enhance the disclosure objectives and requirements in IFRS 3 business combinations in order to improve the information provided to users of financial statements about a business combination and its subsequent performance. The majority of our members agreed and tentatively decided that based on the conceptual framework, information can be required in the financial statements about the benefits an entity's management expects from a business combination and the extent to which management objectives are being met, such as information about the subsequent performance of a business combination and quantitative information about expected synergies. In that regard, the board also discussed practical concerns over requiring entities to include such information in the financial statements. In particular, the board discussed the staff's additional research and analysis of concerns over requiring entities to disclose information that might be considered forward-looking in some jurisdictions. We will continue our discussions around our preliminary views of the package of disclosure requirements in the coming months and consider whether not to proceed with some or all of the proposed disclosure requirements for practical reasons.
Thank you, Andreas. The board also discussed some of the proposals that have been set out in the financial statements project. Could you sum up the discussions around these, please?
Sure. We continued our deliberations on this project. We picked up where we left off last month and discussed the ED's proposal to present results from integral joint ventures and associates separately from non-integral ones. Given the strong pushback obtained in the consultation, the board decided unanimously to proceed with a proposal to require an entity to classify income and expenses from equity accounted associates and joint ventures outside the operating category, but not to proceed with a proposal to require an entity to present the subtotal operating profit or loss and income and expenses from integral associates and joint ventures, and also not to proceed with the proposal to require an entity to identify and present income and expenses from integral associates and joint ventures separately from income and expenses from non-integral associates and joint ventures. With regard to the first of these decisions, the board was split on whether to require presentation of income and expenses from equity accounted investments in associates and joint ventures in the statement of profit or loss directly after operating profit or loss. In fact, I used my casting vote to get us to a majority vote on this issue. We also agreed to explore providing limited application guidance on the so-called function of expense method set out in the exposure draft. In the next part of the board discussion, we decided not to develop a definition of cost of sales, but rather to explore providing application guidance to explain that cost of sales would, as a minimum, include inventory expense as per IAS 2. We also decided to explore retaining the requirement of presenting operating expenses by nature or function, but withdrawing the prohibition to use a mixed presentation, and providing application guidance instead to improve comparability and help achieve faithful presentation. Lastly, we also decided not to explore providing a cost relief for the disclosure of operating expenses by nature in the notes when an entity presents an analysis of its operating expenses by function in the statement of profit or loss. We will discuss the extent of any such disclosures in a future board meeting. Finally, we discussed subtotals found in the statement of profit or loss and decided to include the impairment in the subtotal that specifies an operating profit or loss before depreciation and amortization, so that the subtotal excludes impairments of assets in the scope of IAS 36 as well. And we discussed and decided not to explicitly prohibit the use of the label EBITDA as a label for an operating profit or loss before depreciation and amortization, but to explain in the basis for conclusion that in our view, such a label would rarely be a faithful representation of the subtotal.
Thank you, Andreas. We'll come back to you again shortly, but for now let's turn to Sue, and so we can specifically talk about the post-implementation reviews of IFRS 10, 11 and 12. Did the board identify any areas in these reviews that needed further action?
I think the short answer is a little bit early to say. So we're at the moment coming to an end of the analysis of the feedback that we've got from the post-implementation reviews of IFRS 10, 11 and 12, our consolidation suite of standards, as we sometimes call them. And at this meeting, we heard the first of a two-part summary that we are talking about, looking at the detail of some of the feedback that we've got from the post-implementation review. And at a high level, first of all, we've been told that the standards are working as intended, although there are some specific topics that the board could consider moving on to the standard setting agenda. So we talked about some of these, and they include looking at improving the definition of an investment entity in IFRS 10, looking at some of the requirements around investment entities, for example, some comments that we've got about the way that information is provided when an investment entity parent has a subsidiary that's also an investment entity, looking at research in the diversity and accounting for some collaborative arrangements that aren't captured in the scope of IFRS 11, but where some see parallels in the type of accounting that might be appropriate, looking at transactions structured through corporate wrappers, and then looking at accounting for some changes in the relationship between an investor and an investee. So we looked at the overall feedback on these topics, and board members took the opportunity to make some observations about some of the things that they think would need to be kept in mind if we were to look further at these questions for a standard setting. But the next step will be that we'll look at this feedback again about these potential projects in addition to the feedback we get from the agenda consultation, so that we can look at the feedback identified in this PIR process in a more holistic way in the context of other potential priorities and projects that we could look at further. So I look forward at the moment to the second part of the feedback that the staff will bring to us in preparation for that bigger later discussion.
Thank you, Sue. Coming back to you, Andreas, could you give us a summary of what the board heard in terms of feedback on rate-regulated activities?
Absolutely. In fact, this is the first time this project has been on the agenda since I took over as chair. The board last had a discussion on this project about half a year ago, in March, when it extended the comment period of the exposure draft to the end of July. In that consultation, we proposed a new IFRS standard to give investors a more complete picture of the financial performance of rate-regulated companies. Rate regulation is common in quite a few industries, including but not limited to the health sector, as well as the utilities and public transport industries, to name but a few. We focus on a particular subset of rate regulation where there is a timing difference between the right to charge customers granted to or the obligation to reimburse customers put onto an entity by a regulator and the period in which those rights and obligations actually take effect. Under our current literature, when those differences in timing occur, a revenue a company reports for a period in its income statement and the assets and liabilities it reports in its balance sheet do not give a complete picture of the amount that rate regulation entitles the company to charge for goods and services supplied in that period. Currently, IFRS standards do not even require companies to give investors information about those differences in timing. The standard we are currently developing would introduce a requirement for companies to give investors such information by reporting regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities in their balance sheet and related regulatory income and expense in their income statement. This month, we were informed of feedback in the comment letters received and outreaches conducted. The board received both an overview and detailed feedback on all sections of the ED, ranging from the objective and scope of the proposals through the definition of rate regulation, continuing with recognition, measurement, presentation, and disclosure, to finish with cross-cutting issues and relationships with other IFRS pronouncements. it seems worth pointing out to our podcast listeners that the purpose of this session was to inform the board and not to ask it to make decisions. Board colleagues provided instant reactions to the feedback heard and some sought clarifications on a number of issues presented by our staff. Whilst the majority of the proposals was received very positively by our stakeholders, we also heard concerns in some areas. These include the scope of the proposed standard, definition of total allowed compensation, the requirements around minimum interest rate to be used, as well as interactions with other parts of our literature, notably IFRIC 12 on service concession arrangements. We will continue to hear feedback for this project at our next meeting.
Thank you, Andreas. We'll stay with you and turn our attention onto the IFRS for SMEs project. What can you tell us about what you heard this month?
The board has previously developed a general working principle that any major changes made in the Big Book should be considered for being introduced in the IFRS for SMEs as well. In this month's meeting, the board considered if and to what degree that principle should apply to IFRS 9 on financial instruments, IFRS 13 on fair value measurement, IFRS 14 on regulatory deferral accounts, and IFRS 15 on revenue from contracts with customers. I think it's fair to say that the easiest decisions related to IFRS 13 and 14. On the first, the board decided to align the definition of fair value and the related guidance on its application in the IFRS for SMEs with that in IFRS 13. We also decided to include examples that are relevant to an SME, how to apply the fair value hierarchy. The guidance and related disclosure requirements would be moved to a new section in the SME standard. On the second, being IFRS 14, the board decided not to incorporate the requirements of that standard into the IFRS for SMEs, but to rather consider including requirements for regulatory assets and liabilities once our ongoing project is finalized. With regard to IFRS 9, the board decided to remove the so-called fallback option for SMEs to apply IAS 39 instead of the simplified requirements for financial instruments in the IFRS for SMEs standard, conditional on the alignment of the relevant IFRS for SMEs sections to IFRS 9. We also decided not to change the existing hedge accounting requirements in the IFRS for SMEs standard. Finally, with regard to the principles in IFRS 15, the board decided to develop amendments to the IFRS for SME standard to reflect the principles and language used in IFRS 15, with possible simplifications and transition reliefs to be discussed at future meetings. We look forward to hearing more from this project in future meetings.
It sounds like there is a lot happening on this project, and I'm sure our listeners are looking forward to hearing some more updates in future episodes of this podcast. But for now, let's turn our discussion to the proposed narrow scope amendment to IAS 19 employee benefits. This project is called the Pension Benefits That Depend on Asset Returns project. Sue, can you explain to us what this project is about? And will the project to consider a narrow scope amendment go ahead?
Okay, so this project is looking at providing useful information to investors about a particular type of pension obligation. And we were looking more specifically at the question of the accounting for a type of pension which is categorised in accordance with IAS 19 as a defined benefit obligation, but where some of the payments on the plan are linked to asset performance. And a concern was raised that when companies value the future obligations on those pensions, the pension liability is sometimes seen to be overstated when the discount rate that's used to measure the liability is lower than the rate of return on the assets that the payments are linked to for these types of plans. And some see that as being an overstatement that is less useful information for investors. So we asked the staff to do some research on this, to look at ways to basically cap the rate of return of the assets at the discount rate found in IAS 19 for this very particular subset of plans as a sort of efficient and targeted way of addressing this issue that's come about in practice. And the board had quite a lengthy discussion on this proposal that has been worked on by the staff. And that discussion really came down very much to pros and cons of targeting an amendment on such a very specific population of pension plans, or whether it would be better to wait and consider potentially a bigger project on pension accounting at some future point in time. And after that long debate, on balance, the board decided not to develop a narrow scope amendment based on this idea. So to stop this research project and to consider at a later date whether further work should be done, including based on the feedback that we get from the agenda consultation.
Thank you, Sue. Moving across to the equity method project, Andreas, can you remind our listeners how this project came about and what its status is at the moment?
Sure, and I can be very brief on this. In March of this year, the board decided to identify application questions with IAS 28 and see if the questions can be answered by applying the principles that are inherent in that standard. Now, the project team has since spent time gathering these questions, which cover a variety of topics, including impairment, recognition of losses, and contingent consideration. The board agreed to consider these application questions, but decided that the staff should first research the implications of the differences between the principles in IAS 28 and the principles in other IFRS standards that relate to business combinations and consolidation before considering the application questions.
I expect we'll be hearing more about this in future meetings. Sue, can you update us on recent decisions made by the Interpretations Committee?
Yes, I'll touch both on some of the recent decisions of the committee, but also the narrow scope amendment that the board's looking at. So firstly, on the Interpretations Committee front, at the last Interpretations Committee meeting, they voted to finalise an agenda decision relating to the accounting for non-refundable value-added tax on lease payments, another one on the accounting for warrants that are classified as financial liabilities on initial recognition. And the board was asked whether they objected to the finalisation of those agenda decisions. The board didn't object, so that means that essentially the board has approved those for finalisation. So that will happen now. The board also then talked about an upcoming exposure draft that originated with actually the Interpretations Committee. And it's a set of proposals to make some targeted improvements to disclosures about supplier finance arrangements. At this board meeting, we discussed basically a drafting issue that has come up. We call these sweep issues. It was a sort of a gap in the proposed disclosures. And the board's agreed to fill that gap by proposing to add a requirement that there be a disclosure of the line item or line items in the statement of financial position in which the entity presents the carrying amount of the financial liabilities that are part of the supplier finance arrangement that's being described in the notes to the financial statements.
Thank you, Sue. And staying with you for our last project from the October meeting, and that is the amendments to IFRS 17. Could you update us on what the board heard this month and perhaps start by telling us what this topic is indeed about?
Sure. So going back to June, the board discussed a narrow scope amendment to IFRS 17 to address a one-time classification difference. But basically, the amendment is designed to help address some accounting mismatches that can arise on the initial application of the new insurance standard, IFRS 17. And basically, the amendment's designed to address situations where the measurement of a financial asset will change when IFRS 9 is first applied, but that isn't reflected in the comparative information. And this causes a temporary accounting mismatch in the comparative information between the new IFRS 17 measurement of an insurance liability and the measurement of the asset that ultimately will be resolved when IFRS 9 is applied. So we put out an exposure draft in July with a 60-day comment period to propose a presentation improvement to address that accounting mismatch. So at this meeting, the board discussed the feedback that we got on the exposure draft, which was largely in agreement with the proposals, but we did make a few small changes. Firstly, in response to feedback, we decided to expand the scope of the amendment so that it will also be available for non-insurance related assets. The board decided that the cost of applying a different classification approach to those assets held by insurers that were non-insurance assets wasn't outweighed by the benefits, so we expanded the scope to include those assets. We also made an amendment to the scope to include some companies with insurance liabilities that have already applied IFRS 9. but they're entitled to change the application of the fair value option to their financial assets when they start applying IFRS 17. So we made an amendment to bring those into our scope as well. One thing we didn't change was in response to a request that we got from some, which was to change the date when disclosures are required to be provided about the changes in the measurement of financial assets from the IAS 39 classification to the IFRS 9 classification on the date of initial application. Some people wanted us to move the date of that disclosure to the date of the application of this amendment, which is the beginning of the comparative period. And the board didn't agree to that amendment, largely because this overlay approach in the amendment is optional and it's applied on an asset-by-asset basis. So the board was worried that moving the disclosure to when this amendment has applied could result in a very incomplete set of information for investors about the changes in the measurement of financial assets when a company moves to IFRS 9. So we didn't make that change. So that finalised the discussions on this particular amendment to IFRS 17. So the next step is to formalise that in the document and to publish the amendment. And we are planning to get that done before the end of this year.
Thank you, Sue, and thank you, Andreas. It was a great discussion today, and what we can certainly see is how packed the agenda was for October. Next month, we will have further updates, as well as some more information on the recently announced International Sustainability Standards Board. This board will focus on creating sustainability-related disclosure standards, and its formation was announced by Foundation Trustee Erkki Liikanen at the recent COP26 Climate Change Summit in Glasgow. He made this announcement alongside two other related developments. The first of these was the announcement of a commitment by two leading investor-focused sustainability disclosure organizations to consolidate into the new board. The IFRS Foundation will complete the consolidation of the Climate Disclosure Standards Board and the Value Reporting Foundation by June 2022. The second development that was announced regarded the publication of a prototype climate and a prototype general disclosure requirements developed by the Technical Readiness Working Group. This was a group that was formed by the Foundation trustees to undertake preparatory work for the ISSB. These prototypes are the result of 6 months of joint work by representatives of the CDSB, the International Accounting Standards Board, the Financial Stability Board's Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, the VRF, and the World Economic Forum, supported by the International Organization of Securities Commission, or IOSCO, and its technical expert group of securities regulators. The TRWG has consolidated key aspects of these organizations' content into an enhanced, unified set of recommendations for consideration by the ISSB. We have a lot of materials related to these announcements on our website. You can visit ifrs.org/sustainability to find out more. That's it for this month's episode. You can catch up on previous episodes of this and the IFRS Interpretations Committee podcast on our YouTube channel, as well as Spotify or your preferred podcast player. If you have any comments, please do email us on communications@ifrs.org. And until next time, keep well.